programs and the programs that we test and how we test those. And then I'll delve deeper into the two federal programs that funded the Feeding Our Future. And then at the end of this presentation, we'll talk about increased grant risk as a result of the pandemic. And then we'll move into how to mitigate that risk. So the Federal Single Audit Act was established in 1984 for government. And then in 1990, those federal single audit requirements were extended to nonprofit agencies. So the federal government establishes essentially two thresholds for audits for the state of Minnesota. Those thresholds are, one, any audits that are over, any federal programs over $750,000 in federal expenditures. And then the second threshold is those federal programs are over $30 million. For the ones that are between $750,000 and $30 million, we pick those programs based on risk, but for those federal programs that are over $30 million, we are required to audit them every 3 years. So for example, the Minnesota Department of Education administers two of those programs. And again, these are the same two programs that Feeding Our Future receive funding through. And those are the Child and Adult Care Food Program and then the Summer Food Service Program for Children, which is through the Child Nutrition Cluster. So as I said, we'll pick our audits. So those two programs would be audited every 3 years. And then again, based on risk, we pick other additional programs that are between $750,000 and $30 million. Now, just to note that those thresholds may have changed as a result of a pandemic. So this is when we last completed the federal single audit, which was for activity in fiscal year 20. So the federal government establishes for all federal programs 12 compliance requirements. And then in 1990, they took those 12 requirements and they wanted to focus more on the grants management. So they reduced that down to a maximum of 6 federal requirements. So then as auditors, what we do is we go in and we look at those programs and then the federal agency and the requirements that they've selected, those 6 requirements, we gain an understanding of the internal controls associated with that program. And then we test those internal controls and then we test compliance with the program requirements. And then at the conclusion of the audit, we follow up on all prior or all prior audit findings too. So we submit those findings to the federal government and then we follow up with any prior audit findings from the previous year. So on this slide, these are the two programs that I introduced that Feeding Our Future was again funded through, the Summer Food Service Program and the Child and Adult Care Food Program. And as sure that they have done that for all of their grantees. And then the second part of monitoring is that for grantees that receive over $750 in award and actually expend it over $750,000, they're subject to a single audit, just like the state of Minnesota is. So the Department of Education, the grantor, also needs to make sure that they've obtained and they've reviewed the single audits that were performed of those grantees. And then finally, with monitoring, we're going to make sure that the Department of Education also tracked and followed up on any noted deficiencies. And we want them to track and note those deficiencies from not only the single audit, but from their own site visits or any other sources that they're aware of. And so also just to be clear on that previous slide, I talked about the six requirements for the two programs. So as auditors, we weren't required to test subrecipient monitoring for both of those programs. However, the Department of Education still is required to perform all those subrecipient monitoring requirements. And so on this slide, what we're looking at here is, again, these two programs from the Department of Education. And it really just lays out that in 2017 and 2020, which are the 2 years that we audited these two federal programs, you can see when subrecipient monitoring was required and when it was not. So the federal government does not necessarily keep the same requirements every year. They can change those requirements. So subrecipient monitoring for the summer food program was required in 2017, but it wasn't required in 2020. And then I added 2021 so that you can see that the state auditor who is responsible for auditing that activity this year is not required to do this because this program is over $30 million. It only needs to be done once every 3 years. But as I said in the prior slide, if there is a prior audit finding, they are required to follow up on those prior audit findings. So even if they're not going to audit the entire program, they will need to go back and look at any prior audit findings. So for instance, our office did an audit in fiscal year 20 of the fiscal year 20 activity for these two programs. And specifically for one of the two programs, for one of the two programs, we saw that 31 of 74 single audits were not reviewed by the Department of Education. So the Department of Education, as I had mentioned in an earlier slide, is required in monitoring to obtain and review all single audits performed of grantees that are over $750,000 in expenditures. So in our audit, they did not do that for 31 of those grantees. And then just to be clear on this too, for the fiscal 20 activity, Feeding Our Future did not have expenditures over $750,000. So they were not one of the 74 in this situation. However, in fiscal year 21, which is the year audited by the state auditor, they would be subject to a single audit because their expenditures were over $750,000. And so here we just wanted to talk about the increased risk that were associated with the pandemic and just kind of highlight two in particular, one being waivers that bypass the normal controls and the other being increase in funding. These will be on the next two slides. So specifically for the waivers, what ended up happening is for those two programs, there was a number of waivers that were applied to both of those food programs that related to subrecipient monitoring. And so one, for example, was for the child and adult food program. They were required to annually review 33.3% of all grantees and then also do a pre-approval visit for all of their new grantees. However, the federal government waived this requirement and they encouraged but did not require the grantor to continue performing those offsite. And then for increase in funding, just wanted to talk about here specifically for these two food programs. I just wanted to give a layout of the expenditures. So for the last two fiscal years, you can see the total federal expenditures. Again, these are for the two programs, the two that we talked about, the summer food program and the child and adult food program. there was 158 million in 2020, and the activity increased to 736 million in 2021. Then on the second row, you can see I'm just taking a look at a subset of the total expenditures, and that's great for grants, aids, and subsidies. And then on the third row, you can see I took it down one more and just looked at a subset of the grants, and those were the activity to non-governmental entities. And then finally, you can see on the fourth row that this is the activity related to Feeding Our Future. So you can see in 2020, the percentage of the non-governmental entities was 6.7% for Feeding Our Future. And then in 2021, it increased to 43% in the non-governmental entities. That's $135 million at the increase from fiscal 20 to fiscal 21. And then in these last two slides, we just want to talk about the risk mitigation for agencies and the risk mitigation for the legislature. So on this slide, we're taking a look at the agencies, and we want to make sure agencies continue to do robust monitoring, and probably now more than ever with the influx of funding that's come through because of the pandemic. So for instance, with monitoring, we're looking at obtaining and reviewing documentation. We want to make sure that they're considering things that have a direct impact when they review things. So for an example would be reviewing invoices to make sure that that's something that was approved on the grant agreement and that there's adequate support for that expenditure. And then we also expect for an observation of the performance. So even if there's a waiver in place that allows you to do a desk audit as opposed to going on site, we would still expect the Department of Education or any other agency to make a strong effort in making those really effective, those site visits. And then we also wanted to point out that the Office of Grants Management also has a monitoring policy as well. So the federal government has requirements of subrecipient monitoring, but then the state as well has its own policy. So the Department of Education has to take into consideration both. And so for the Office of Grants Management, they require visits in person or by phone for grantees over 100 or for grantees over 50,000 before final payment. They need to have one visit. And then for those over 250,000, they need to have a site visit done annually. But as I said, the site visit isn't required to be on site, it can be by phone. And then they're also required to do a financial reconciliation. And so that's really taking a look at the documentation that supports any reimbursements. And they need to do this for any grantee that is over 50,000 before final payment is made. And then finally, they need to do a risk assessment, kind of like the risk assessment I already talked about that the federal government requires. The state also requires this as well, and that's for any grantee over 50,000. Now, just to note here too, that there are exceptions to these requirements that can be approved by the Commissioner of Administration. And then finally, what can the legislature do or consider with risk mitigation? And so one thing is really having a clear purpose for a grant and ask such questions as what should this grant accomplish, what services should be provided, and what are the eligibility requirements? Those are just examples. And then refrain from naming grantees in law. This is something we've seen historically when we've done audits of grants, is that there's legislatively named grantees. And unfortunately, there's agencies that perform less oversight over these grantees because they believe that when they're named in law, that they're required that money and that there's nothing that the agency can do to stop payment on those grantees. And then finally, we're really wanting you to consider reviewing the monitoring requirements as well. Given that flexibility that we saw on that previous slide where the Office of Grants Management offers either a site visit that they can go on site or doing a phone visit. And it's much different when you go on site with a grantee and you can physically see the progress that they're making and observe their activities versus having a conversation on the phone with a grantee. So we think it's really important that the legislature really take a look at that. But reviewing the monitoring requirements, the legislature has already taken action and has approved OLA to do an evaluation of grants. So that is something that has already occurred. So with that, that ends my presentation. And if there's any questions,
thank you, Ms. Lyson. Take a couple of quick ones here, then we have to move on. Thank you for that. A couple of quick questions. One, page four, just want to clarify something. You said 31 of 74 single audits were not reviewed. Is that a requirement in federal law to do that, to review all of those?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Yes, that's required. So any grantee, this is coming from the federal government. So any grantee expending over $750,000 needs to receive a federal single audit. So just like the state of Minnesota, where we audit the state, or currently the state auditor audits the state, a grantee would then have to obtain their own single audit. And then the grantor, here being the Department of Education, is responsible to obtain that audit, that single audit performed of that grantee, and then review it and track those deficiencies that are affiliated with their program.
Thank you, Ms. Lyson. One more. So on the bottom of page five, it was also noted that MDE, the Department of Education, was not required. The federal government threw a lot of money at this, and then they put a lot of waivers out there. But it's my understanding that with this language that they weren't required, but it didn't say it was prohibited, correct? So you could still go out there and do something, correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The federal government still wanted them to pursue monitoring, but they weren't requiring that to be on site. So they really encouraged it. They wanted that to continue, but it wasn't that it could go away altogether.
Okay, thank you. We'll take one more from Senator Isaacs and we'll move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at what appears to be 8 on your slide deck. Is this slide in any way related to the fraud case of Feeding Our Future? Because you had said that there was 31 of 74, but that wasn't connected to Feeding Our Future. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that is correct.
So why is it in this slide deck then?
So it's in this slide to just draw attention to subrecipient monitoring, and that there needs to be oversight by any state agencies, such as the Department of Education. So although Feeding Our Future was not one of those 74 in fiscal 20, they would be one of those in fiscal 21. They did have over $750,000 in expenditures. So whoever they hire to perform a single audit, they are required to do so. And then the Department of Education is then required to obtain and review that single audit.
So just to give a poke to MDE then from you guys.
Correct.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, the reason was not to poke at MDE, as you suggested. The other reason for pointing this out was that we had a finding in 2020 on this issue, which then meant that Office of State Auditor would have to follow up on that in its current financial audit, its single audit in 21. So that was why we were drawing your attention to it, is to point out where the testing of subrecipient monitoring would be expected to happen in this current.
But audit. Again, not related to the actual fraud situation. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Randall and Ms. Lyson. Thank you very much for your work and what you do out there for all the stuff across the board. It's a lot of work. Thank you very much. Next up, we're going to have some testimony from Kathy Mays from Loaves and Fishes. Again, we're just kind of, so one concern here is that stuff like this tends to impact and affect other nonprofits. There are a lot of good nonprofits out there, good, do a good job. And we want to make sure that we recognize that as well. And Miss, we asked Loaves and Fishes to come and share a few thoughts about their process, because they were part of an article in either the Strib or the Pioneer Press or both about this situation. So we wanted them to come in, share some information about their what they do and how they prevent this sort of fraud. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with for the record. You may begin. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Mays. I'm the Executive Director of Loaves and Fishes Minnesota. I just will outline what I think you want to hear, how much money we make, what the requirements are, what the requirements are for on meals before COVID, after COVID, and then some of my thoughts. And I have props that will help. So we've been doing this since 2010. Typically, in a normal year, we don't make money. 2019, we received 95,000 and we paid out 59,000. Not a big money maker for us. So yearly requirements, we are required to apply to be a sponsor. We need to raise our hand and say we want to be a sponsor again. We have to create other applications for sites that have changed locations. We have to reapply for each site every year and share our schedule of meals.
Ms. Mays, I just want to confirm something. Are you defined as a sponsor, correct?
We are a sponsor.
So you receive the funds and you distribute them. Okay, thank
correct.
You.
We visit every site once a year and twice for new sites. And we do that ourselves as well as the MDE. Every site must display posters. I'm getting a little granular on this, but this poster needs to be displayed. If it's not, meals that day are not counted. We also all year long have a Justice for All poster. So all the posters must be, and I'll talk about the posters. And then we also get extra audited items from MDE, which are always fun. Meal requirements. We must contain a protein, a grain, a fruit, vegetable, and a milk. Snacks, you only have to have 2 of 4. They all have to be certain amounts. This is a 6 ounce, a 4 ounce, and a 2 ounce. They watch to see what spoon you're using. All components must be recorded by the serving size and quantity. Oh, they also require a picture of the meal. So here is a picture of a meal. This is in Inver Grove Heights. This is what the meal was. It says it was a pork butt roasted. Okay. So there it is. It's pork, rice, coleslaw, fruit, and vegetables. And that night we served 26 children. We have to show how many children were there that night. We actually count them as they walk through the door with a clicker. Adult meals are also served, and we have to document those as well. All of the meals before COVID needed to be consumed on site. There were no to-goes allowed. Weekly forms would verify the daily meal counts. And then because we do this all year round, they don't really monitor our kitchens. We do that, and so do you. We then send in the meal counts. And that's all we send in. We don't send in any of this. This happens when they come to site and audit. So we tell them we served, 500 children, 555, 556. It's never a static amount. During the pandemic, we no longer were required to see the children on site. We made a sign that said, we need to know if any of these are for children. And then we go up to the car and the mom would say, I need 2. 2 for adults and 2 for children. And we also told our staff, do not assume that same mom who drives up tomorrow is going to need 2 for children. She needs to say it's 2 for adults, 1 for a child tonight. We did have some findings. It was very fun. I will tell you how fun it was. We had some findings back in 2018. Let me tell you what they were. The writing on the forms were not legible. The poster didn't have the right time, or it was not legible. Our other finding was we didn't have special diet requirements. Well, we don't do that. Everybody eats the same thing every night. Documentation of labels. They wanted to know what was actually in the food we were serving. And at Loaves and Fishes, we could not show them this on everything. We tried our best, but if it was chicken, gall darn it, it was chicken. This is Tyson, and this is golden, crispy, breaded chicken tenders, and they wanted to know what was in it. We had an inaccurate count one night. It was hilarious. This is two teenage volunteers, we were told, could have been counted as served as children. Therefore, we undercounted that day. A hood vent in one of our kitchen was cleaned by staff and not professionally, and they made us have the hood vent cleaned professionally. This is not an easy program. And there
have been— Ms. May, just a quick question. When you say they, that's who?
MDE.
Okay, thank you.
I have thought long and hard about this program, but here's what is the bonus for us. In the summer, we open up sites that are extra, the YMCAs, Salvation Armies. They don't have food for their children. We become their food. We hire interns. They have jobs. We work hard to feed good food. The kids get healthy meals. For us, it's worth it for that. It's not the money.
That concludes your testimony?
That concludes okay. My testimony. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer
them. It was very helpful and instructive. Highly regulated then, right?
I mean, highly regulated.
You showed the different sizes and scoops and you talked about the findings. Highly regulated, so it would be hard for someone to come in and just pick this up and go. You got to have some background experience, correct?
Correct. And it's so regulated that we would not allow anybody to just use our sponsorship.
They couldn't do what, Ms. May?
We would not allow another organization to use our sponsorship and go do this work.
Sure.
We're going to keep this really close.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Members, we have time for a question. If you have one, Senator Duckworth.
Just one. I would imagine that the work you do in your experience, very, very difficult to scale, especially very quickly. Would that be an accurate assumption to make?
Ms. May?
Yes, very difficult to scale, Senator.
Thank you. So we're going to move on to the commissioner now. Thank you, Ms. May. Very instructive.
Thanks.
Thank you for your help. Okay, now, Commissioner Mueller.
May I close this?
What's that, Commissioner?
May I close this or no?
Yeah, that one you can. That the other one is the one for the. Yeah. Thank you. Well, welcome to welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Thank you for attending today to help to answer some of these questions. And I mean, honestly, they're not all going to be easy, but I think these sorts of things tend to lead us down difficult paths that we have to address. So. You get to, we said you could have a couple minutes to kick it off. So a couple minutes, go ahead, Commissioner. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss the federal child nutrition programs and MDE's work to administer these programs in Minnesota. My name is Heather Mueller, and I am the Commissioner of Education. Joining me today are Adosh Uni, MDE's Director of Government Relations, and Eric Tobel, our General Counsel. The federal child nutrition programs play a critical role in our students' overall well-being because childhood hunger can have a lasting impact not only on our students' academic success, but also on their mental health, both in school and outside of school. Federal child nutrition programs regulations clearly specify the role of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the role of the state agency, the role of the sponsor organization, and the role of individual sites. In Minnesota's case, MDE serves as the state agency administering these programs, and our role, based on the federal nutrition regulations, is to work with sponsors such as school districts, child care programs, and nonprofit organizations who in turn manage sites who are served meals. I am grateful for that our team at MDE takes advantage of the work that we do and takes our role incredibly seriously in working with these federal programs, and staff work diligently to ensure that the federal regulations are met. In fact, MDE's nutrition team has received accolades from the USDA on multiple occasions for administration of the nutrition programs in Minnesota, and more recently, high praise from the FBI and the US Attorney's Office. While our MDE team oversees many nutrition programs today, I am focusing on two programs in particular, the Summer Food Service Program, also known as SFFP, and Child and Adult Care Food Program at Risk, also known as CACFP. While our MDE, I'll walk through some information about the federal investigation into Feeding Our Future and MDE's diligent efforts to catch the inexplicable growth of Feeding Our Future's program very early on, flag it for the USDA, and continue pushing until we eventually began working through the FBI. I want to be very clear that it was our team's diligent monitoring that allowed us to identify concerns within the program so quickly in the summer of 2020, and MDE is not under investigation. While there will be some aspects of this process that I won't be able to address today on the ongoing and federal investigation of Feeding Our Future, I will be able to provide you with a general overview. As you know, on January 20th, 2022, federal law enforcement agents executed multiple search warrants at properties associated with site operations under Feeding Our Future, a sponsor of USDA child nutrition programs across the state of Minnesota. As a result, on January 20th, 2022, MDE moved to immediately terminate Feeding Our Future's permanent agreement under USDA's Child and Adult Care Food Program and the Summer Food Service Program, and issued a stop pay order to halt all payments to Feeding Our Future. These, however, were not the first actions MDE took with Feeding Our Future. Feeding Our Future began operating the Summer Food Service Program on June 30th, 2020. In late July of 2020, MDE observed rapid growth in the number of community sites sponsored by Feeding Our Future, as well as an exponential increase in meal reimbursement claims and dollars flowing to the sponsor. MDE staff repeatedly worked with Feeding Our Future representatives to understand the increased demand, but did not receive sufficient information and supporting documentation to explain the increase in the meal reimbursement claims. During this time, MDE staff also reached out to the USDA Midwest Regional Office multiple times, each month seeking advice and support regarding the inexplicably rapid growth. In October of 2020, MDE escalated the issue to the USDA Office of the Inspector General. After MDE raised concerns about the number of new sites being sponsored by Feeding Our Future and the unexplained increase in meal reimbursement claims, Feeding Our Future filed a lawsuit against MDE in November of 2020. MDE stopped approving Feeding Our Future's new summer food service program applications in December of 2020, and MDE denied dozens of Feeding Our Future site applications that month. As a reminder, during the pandemic, the summer food service program was operational during the entire 2020-2021 school year. In January 2021, MDE declared Feeding Our Future seriously deficient due to incomplete financial audits and a lapsed nonprofit status with the IRS. In spring 2021, MDE again declared Feeding Our Future seriously deficient for nonconformance with the USDA CACFP performance standards. As a result of the seriously deficient determination, MDE denied multiple applications from Feeding Our Future to open more sites. As a result of the second serious deficiency determination, MDE again issued a stop pay order that halted all payments to Feeding Our Future to give MDE time to verify that all meal claim reimbursements submitted were valid and allowable. On April 21st, 2021, a judge told MDE that it did not have the authority to stop payment to Feeding Our Future and needed to continue paying Feeding Our Future claims. On April 2021 is also when MDE began working with the FBI after months of raising our hands and requesting USDA officials look into these concerns. In June 2021, the judge in Ramsey County case held MDE in contempt of court and assessed fines of over $35,750 and attorney's fees of $11,750. That summer and fall, Feeding Our Future continued to file motions for additional injunctions and orders of contempt. At this point, it's also important to remember that the rules and requirements for child nutrition programs are outlined in federal regulations, and MDE does not have general rulemaking authority in the state of Minnesota. Therefore, MDE does not have the authority to implement additional requirements outside of the federal regulations or to investigate. Even so, our MDE team worked tirelessly to make sure that our concerns did not go unchecked. As the federal agents work through this case, ensuring that children are not going hungry continues to be our priority. MDE continues to work with community organizations and other SFSP and CACFP at-risk sponsors and sites to ensure that impacted children and families have access to the food and support they need. We are working with site operators who have been impacted by the termination of Feeding Our Futures agreement and will continue to do so while ensuring that the program regulations are being met. As I conclude, I'd like to remind you that throughout the FBI's investigation, Feeding Our Future, our MDE staff has been praised for their diligence in identifying concerns within the program so quickly and being persistent as we face both public and legal blowback. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate that. Henceforth, the CA Child and Adult Care Food Program and the Summer Food Service Program will be referred to as the Federal Nutrition Program, Federal Food Nutrition Programs. Just starting out earlier in March, March 4th, we had requested some documents and other data from the department. We did receive the timeline. We received it this morning, so thank you for that. So Commissioner, today when you arrived, do you or any of your staff have the applications for the sponsored sites that, or the 990s of those sponsored sites that we asked for? Do you have any of those documents today?
We do not have them with us at this time.
Okay, thank you. Do you have copies of any of the communications and notes between MDE and the governor's office and related to FOF in this case?
Chair Chamberlain, we do not at this time.
And just, did you bring any other documents related communications within the department related to FOF with you today?
Chair Chamberlain, not at this time.
Thank you. Thank you. And again, we got the timeline, so thank you for that. So we also, just to establish, we had requested that others testify on either April 6th or the 20th. On April 6th, will Denise Anderson, who's a CFO, I believe, of MD, will she be able to join us on the 6th? Do you know?
Yes, Chair Chamberlain, she will be able to join us.
She'll join us. And we also asked for that Katrina Jones, she's risk mitigation and internal control, would she be able to join us that day as well?
Chair Chamberlain, I do believe we asked for the 20th for Katrina Jones, if that is possible.
Okay. All right, 20th for Katrina, yeah, that is possible. And finally on this, just this area, on the 20th specifically, would Darren Corte, Assistant Commissioner Corte, be available on the 20th?
Yes, Chair Chamberlain, he will be available.
I'll just go down the list. Will Monica Herrera?
Yes, Chair Chamberlain.
And I understand, what was it, Sonia
Smith?
She is not in the part in that chain, so thank you. Katrina Jones, will she be available?
Yes, Chair Chamberlain.
And then two more, Jenny Butcher and Camille Jones, will they be available on the 20th?
Yes, they will both be available.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
And we'll
that.
Send you formal in that in writing this afternoon.
All right, thank you. Okay. So when we were reviewing, obviously, for you attorneys out there, we're reviewing all these documents, right? So myself and others went through a lot of these documents. And in those court documents, there were a lot of questions about federal food service programs and who could testify and who knew what, who could be deposed. To establish this, before you were commissioner, you were a deputy commissioner, correct?
Yes, Chair Chamberlain.
And so, I'm just trying to establish a chain here. You're experienced and well-versed. So Minnesota Statute 15.06 defines responsibilities. And in that statute, to paraphrase, 15.06 sub 7, it deals with the deputy commissioner. And essentially you step into their position unless the commissioner decides otherwise, correct? I mean, that's a lot of responsibility. They have, according to depositions and other information, the commissioner by precedent was not required to testify. You weren't required for a variety of reasons, but the deputy commissioner would have knowledge and be working in that place, correct?
Judge Amblin, I think that that really depends. There were a number of other pieces that as the deputy commissioner at that point in time that I was working on. And so the commissioner at that point and I had really talked about how it is we would be able to utilize our time.
Okay, so I'll follow up on that particular one. So the commissioner at the time was Mary Catherine Ricker. Was she fully in charge of oversight of this process then? As she was there, she left. She resigned, I think, in March 9th of 2021. You were appointed and took the office on April 1st. So did Commissioner, at that time, Mary Catherine Ricker, did she handle the majority of these issues regarding the establishment of the federal, of this food program and the waivers and the increased funding? Was she in charge of that or was that you?
At that point in time, it was Mary Catherine Ricker.
Okay, so at that time, Commissioner, then Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker was in charge of the oversight and taking charge of this new program where the waivers, where they're created waivers and the increased funding. Okay, so Did you understood the accelerated increased risk, correct, of the waivers and the extra money coming in, the substantial money coming in? You clearly understood that increased risk, correct?
Yes, Judge Amberlin, I do understand that increased risk.
Is it your belief that the commissioner then, Mary Catherine Ricker, understood that risk, increased risk as well?
That, Chair Chamberlain, I'm not going to be able to speak to. I'm not going to be able to speak to what she knew or did not know or assume or did not assume.
Okay, thank you. So, with the advent of the COVID, the shutdowns and the federal government funding and the waivers, and given the increased risk, did you decide to meet with the leadership team to discuss this new situation and how all that money and all those waivers would be managed? So we had this, you were deputy commissioner.
Right.
Mary Catherine Ricker was commissioner. This pandemic hits, and obviously you were dealing with other things in the whole department, right? Whole series of issues. But this was clearly one issue that had to be dealt with and managed as well. You have a finance team, you have a nutrition services team. Did either you or as deputy commissioner or Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker establish that you, did you bring together an emergency team, you sit down in a room and say, here's what we got, here's what we're gonna do. Did you gather your team together and discuss that problem and how did you discuss the problem? Did you bring the team together and then was that problem discussed, how you might deal with it?
Chair Chamberlain, as deputy commissioner, I did not bring that team together. I won't be able to speak to what Mary Catherine Ricker was able to do, but I do know that our risk assessment team, our finance team, and our nutrition team, as well as all of the other teams, as money was coming in for grants and support, did review our processes and identify ways that we were going to be able to meet the letter and intent and spirit of the law, in addition to being able to also be flexible, as there were a lot of changing pieces that were happening with the pandemic.
Okay, I'm going to follow up on that a little bit. So now you're, so at the time, still before you came commissioner, still in that period. Okay. At the time in 2020, when commissioner, when the commission was Mary Catherine Ricker and you were deputy, you said that she had charge of it and you really didn't have play a big role in that, that some teams got together and kind of were working on the issues. So, commissioner, in the middle of that, right, with this thing coming on, the money in 2021, the money going to Partners in Nutrition increased 15-fold, and the money going to Feeding Our Future increased 30-fold, give or take a dollar or two. Remember, you have some of those dollars in your packets, and it was in the search warrants as well. People got together, kind of chatted about stuff. Part of the process, so it raised concerns. I understand that, right? It raised concerns. So part of the problem is these site visits, I would guess. When they came out with the waivers suggesting that site visits weren't required, was that the position of the department that they were optional and that those site visits could be waived and you weren't going to do them?
Chair Chamberlain, actually our team was able to really look at ways that they would be able to do that in alternative ways. And so there were opportunities where first they were utilizing cell phones and they would go like video calls. They would
Commissioner, I'll get to that in a minute. Okay. But was it the position of the department, either with the Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker or yourself, that the site visits were still critical?
So, Chair Chamberlain, we know that that site visits continue to be critical early on, especially with Feeding Our Future. You'll see in the timeline that MDE staff did go out and do a preliminary site visit in order to give them the opportunity to do SFSP to be able to, or the nutrition programs. And so we do know that there was a site visit that was done for Feeding Our Future. As we learned more about the pandemic and as we had more staff who did have concerns also about exposure and learning more as we learned more throughout that process.
It was your position, to be clear, that site visits were optional? Is that yes or no?
Well, were they? I think site visits were intended to be important and continue to utilize, but they were not the only way to be able to monitor.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go on to this other little section. We're going to jump forward now just for a few minutes. Some of the court documents said that you had there was a conflict of interest. When you became commissioner, we're going to be in a position where you're commissioner, it's after April 1st of 2021, and you're commissioner now. So we're going to move that forward and you're there now. Some of those court documents, that due to your role, you couldn't, part of the problem with you giving a sworn deposition was due to your role as an administrative appeal board, as the chief executive, is that a good idea to be limited in your role in the oversight of such things, to be on that appeal board? So do you think your appeal board, being on the appeal board in the department, is a good thing for the chief executive? Because according to the documents and the courts, that inhibited your ability to it was one of the arguments against testifying or being deposed. So is that, being on the appeal board, is that a position that the commissioner should hold?
Thank you, Chair Chamberlain. I appreciate you, all of your patience. We just want to make sure we are not stepping in, stepping into any investigations. And so we know that at that point in time, there were a couple of pieces that were important of note. There were points where the deputy commissioner serves also on an appeals panel, and then there are times when it may be the commissioner. And so in that litigation strategy, we were in the middle of a, a lawsuit from Feeding Our Future. And so it was a strategy that was utilized in order to ensure that the work that we were doing and the information really helps to still keep that cushion between.
So Commissioner, thank you. So to that point, is it a good thing for the commissioner, the executive, the where the buck stops, so to speak, that commissioner to be in a position of, in a way, a conflict of interest because you run an appeals board, and part of the argument again was because of that and because of president being a commissioner that you did not need to be deposed, or you were protected from that. So is that position on the appeals board, is that something that should change, I suppose? Should the commissioner sit on the appeals board when that creates a conflict of interest?
Chair Chamberlain, thank you for that question. That is something that actually that as we are walking through this, it gives us the opportunity to look back and reflect and make decisions about how we want to be able to proceed moving forward. That is how it was. And so that is how the decision is made. But as you know, this also gives us the opportunity to make adjustments if we believe it's appropriate. And so we'll be sitting with our general counsel and our team to make the best determinations as we move forward.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Thank you, Commissioner. So, okay, we're going to still kind of keep you in the commissioner's spot. It's still after April 1st. When you were deputy commissioner, you said that the then Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker was overseeing this and coordinating it. We'll get back to another question about who brought teams together to kind of deal with this. So if you did not, when you took charge, well, as deputy even, but when you took charge of the department, if you were not controlling that and managing that whole process, who was in charge of preparing the MDE employees to be effectively administer that increased funding and the oversight? Who was in charge of oversight of that funding and administering that whole process? Was that you as commissioner, or was it somebody else?
So Chair Chamberlain, as I stepped into that role in April of 2021, the grants were already up and running and the pieces were moving. I had the opportunity to be brought up to speed on some specific components that were aligned with what was happening with Feeding Our Future. We also know that we have a great team of people, not only in our food and nutrition programs, but also in our finance and executive team to help to lead that.
Thank you for that. It's really a two-word answer. I know things move around, but after you took charge, you weren't in charge of overseeing it before because you said Commissioner Ricker was. So now you're commissioner and you weren't directly overseeing it. Who had direct responsibility for oversight of the federal government food nutrition program and the distribution of those funds? Who was that? If not you, who was it?
Well, I'm going to say honestly that Chair Chamberlain, because I'm the leader of the organization, it is me. And then I have team members that I partner with who are working more directly with it, but it is my responsibility.
So, okay, thank you, Commissioner. So we're going to go back to the site visit thing. I just want to clarify this. Did the Department of Education at any time willingly adopt the optional federal waiver to make site visits optional during this time? Was there, during that period, did anybody at MDE make the decision to accept the optional site visits and not visit sites for the time. Was that decision ever made at MDE?
Chair Chamberlain, the answer is yes.
Okay, so there was a point where it was determined not to visit sites, okay.
And may I add on to that for a moment? Okay, so yes, that decision was made and there were alternative ways to be able to do that. And so while that was part of the-
You're getting ahead, okay. now I'm right there. So, but you would agree, Commissioner, that site visits are important, right? The site visits are critically important.
Yes, I think they are one critical component.
All right. So during this time, did the site visits decrease? During that, say from March 20, from the onset, say, let's just say April 1st, because it took a little bit of time for the federal money to come through and things to organize. So, and you said that at one point that the decision was made not to make site visits. Do you think that the infrequency of site visits contributed to the ability of these organizations to steal the money? Do you think the reduced site visits helped to increase or contributed to the ability of these organizations to commit theft?
So Chair Jamelin, I think that it's important to note that it is one of the components. The other really important component to being able to do a review and an audit is to really not only do the site visit, but also review the financial documents. And that is why our team was able to catch and have questions about what was happening with Feeding Our Future and the exponential growth is the financial documents and the number of meal reimbursements didn't make sense. And so that was less than a month after they began serving food and meals that our team was able to identify that it was a concern. And then throughout that process continued to be able to do that. And so when I say that it's one critical component, it is one critical component, but the other piece is really also being able to look at those other pieces. And that's what our team was able to do. It's what the FBI and the US Attorney's General's Office has been able to flag, is that we were incredibly quick in being able to identify the causes. I think that what actually allowed the theft to continue was the number of barriers that we encountered every time we raised the question and the issue.
Well, we're gonna stay in site visits here for a minute, Commissioner. So one of the search warrants, I won't read off the whole thing in the citation, it's long, but if somebody wants it, I can get it. It's in one of the search warrants. The FBI search warrant says, quote, state government stay-at-home order and telework policies left the program vulnerable to fraud and abuse. We kind of already established site visit issues. So that was unquote. So in the midst of the COVID, during an October 16, 2021 site visit, one of your employees was accused of stealing a bag of groceries. Now, I'm not getting into that. I read through it. I mean, okay. But so one of your employees was there in October of 2021. So they did make a site visit. So they were out at sites, correct?
Yes, Chair Chamberlain, that's correct.
Thank you. And some of them also went on weekends, correct? So site visits were performed on weekends, correct?
Chair Chamberlain.
Yes. And I'm sorry, your name again, sir?
Eric Taubel, T-A-U-B-E-L, General Counsel for MDE.
Hubble, correct,
Taubel, sir? Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I just like to caution yourself and the panel not to tread too closely to the federal investigation for risk of compromising the work our federal partners are doing. Mm-hmm. So specifically asking the commissioner to comment or verify on allegations made in the affidavits by the FBI agents supporting their search warrants, I think is probably a line we don't want to cross today. And so I'd appreciate if the questions didn't find their root in the veracity of the claims in the affidavits filed.
I mean, like the alleged stealing of food, that particular?
If your question begins with the paragraphs in the affidavit supporting the search warrants, I would advise the commissioner not to answer those questions because we don't want to imperil the investigation.
So if it, just so I understand, so if I'm citing from a search warrant, that would be, you're saying get into that interference area, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the commissioner has already testified that the department is not under investigation. I assume she is not under investigation. Normally, we would see a refusal to comment on an ongoing investigation that involves law enforcement. I really don't understand the legal basis that the commissioner would have for refusing to answer questions because of an ongoing FBI investigation that they are not involved in or under investigation of.
Ms. Hubel?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman. Had a look around the computer.
Yeah, sorry. As the affidavits make clear, MDE is a central figure in the investigation, and MDE's role in the investigation, we want to be good partners with our federal law enforcement partners. And they've asked that we not interfere with their investigation. And all I'm suggesting is that commentary on the affidavits that are the foundation for the search warrants and the federal investigation, commentary by MD or the commissioner on conversations we've had with those partners, the contents of these affidavits could imperil the investigation and put at risk the hard work those over 200 FBI agents were doing on January 20th when they searched those over 14 properties.
Thank you very much. I understand, but the they were public documents, and so people are free to discuss as they wish. But that being the case, let me ask this then. Weekend site visits are not unusual, correct? Weekend site visits are conducted, correct?
Judge Amblin, that historically there have been weekend site visits that have occurred.
Thank you. One or two more here. And you had mentioned earlier, Commissioner, about other ways to do it. And that's how we kind of get to this. So site visits were done. We know that. The weekends, they are done in person. And also, site visit can be done by automobile, right? You could get in the car and sit there and see if people are going in and out, right? That's correct. So you could do a staff member could sit in a car to watch a site to see, for example, if a couple thousand kids are coming every day, right?
Well, Chair Chamberlain, that would be one small piece of then what also happens during that site visit. That site visit also looks for, and you heard from previous testimony, also looks at the types of foods that are being served, the way that food is being served, also looks for the health and safety, making sure that there are pieces within the health and safety components that are also part of that process. And so sitting in a car and counting students, it would be a very minor piece of what we're really looking for.
Thank you. Just to sum this up on the sites then, which is a vital part of this thing, because that doing that might have prevented some things from happening. Just to sum up, and I think you said this earlier, but I want to be clear. So site visits are an important part of the compliance process for this sort of thing, especially now with COVID and all this money coming in, and perhaps you're 6-7 months into this and you've been challenged by FOF for what you've been doing, but you would still agree that, especially now, site visits at that point, at the beginning, middle, and end, site visits are a critical component to helping mitigate this sort of fraud, correct? Just to sum up, I just make sure we get that clear.
Chair Chamberlain, I would reiterate that it is one important component. It is not the most important component. And so I think that you have to look at it in the entirety of what is required in the reviews and not just solely from one perspective. So it is one critical component, yes, but not the only.
Okay, thank you. And this is kind of a tail end of that site visit, so we'll get off of sites in a second. But most of us are familiar with the Safari restaurant issue. And at one point, Safari was providing information that they were serving 5,000 children a day. First question, did that raise concerns for you, or did we answer who was in charge of the food nutrition of this, overseeing this program? You weren't in directly, the deposition said you were not directly involved in the day-to-day ops. No. So did we get the name, I'm sorry, did we get the name of who is in charge of the day-to-day ops of an oversight of this operation yet?
That would be thank you for asking the question. That would be our team, for our food nutrition team, Director Monica Herrera, Assistant Commissioner Cordy, who you both hearing from.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. So the 5,000 a day, whether it's you or the team, or maybe they advised you, did you or someone else believe that 5,000 serving all of a sudden a restaurant, as we learned, it's highly regulated operation, as you know, and we learned today. So when you were getting reports of up to 5,000 a day being served at Safari Restaurant, did that raise any red flags for you? Did you know about that? Did that raise any red flags for you?
Chair Chamberlain, when you look back at the timeline, that has raised red flags for us since a month into the pandemic. Okay. The number of, by able to look at the number of meals that were being served, the exponential growth, looking at the funding that was going into Feeding Our Future, the sponsor itself, were places where our team identified that there were areas of concern. And so it is the prime reason, quite frankly, that we're here today, is because our team was able to identify within a month that there was exponential growth that could not be explained, that there was financial information.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. So you identified that, but it went on for a while of serving those number of meals for quite some time, even though there were flags raised and people were concerned. They continued to serve, and you continue to get reports. Now, this is very specific. Did anyone that you know of, or did Assistant Commissioner Corte send someone out in a car to watch or monitor Safari? You mentioned that there were red flags all over and that people were looking at things and they were concerned. So when you learned about the 5,000 a day, did someone go say, we have to take a car and we had to drive to that location and monitor that? Because we don't know, this seems very unusual. It's highly regulated. They just popped up the last few months with their, they organized, right? And all of a sudden they're feeding 5,000 a day. So did anybody decide to go to that location in an automobile and just sit there and take a look?
Chair Chamberlain, I'm not going to be able to answer that question because I don't know the answer at this moment.
Okay, thank you. I had another part to that, but I won't do it. I mean, you would agree that 5,000 a day was exceedingly high.
Chair Chamberlain, I think that, yes, I would agree that that is incredibly high. I think that it's also important to, to remember that at that point in time, we knew that we were going to be serving meals to every single student as possible across the state of Minnesota because of the waivers that were given through the USDA. What we didn't know was the number of students that were going to participate. We knew the number of students who had historically participated. We knew the number of students who received free nutrition price lunches.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. So the one final piece on that, so the red flags, you said that people saw red flags, your staff was alerted, you were concerned, they were concerned, maybe former Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker was concerned. So let's take that one incident. There were several like that in different places, but that one I think helps. If someone drove out to that site, that would have identified clearly that something was wrong, correct?
Chair Chamberlain, we knew clearly that something was wrong by looking at the information that was on the meal
disbursement. But yet, Commissioner, you continued to pay them, and you didn't stop that one, right?
Actually, we stopped paying the sponsor. So the sponsor is Feeding Our Future. The mm-hmm. site is Safari. We don't pay directly to sites. We pay directly to sponsors.
Right.
And so it's the responsibility, just as you had heard in prior testimony, which is, I'm sure, why she does it also is very close to monitoring how it is okay, that they utilize their name.
So I agree. I mean, to be clear, I agree. The sponsor has responsibilities. Right. I agree. But ultimately, money starts with you at the department. Not you, the department. And I'm going to move on from that because I'll wrap that. It just seems to me that if you went to the site, you would have identified it clearly that they're not feeding any children there at that time. So your suspicions would have been confirmed, and we'd be, your suspicions would have been confirmed. Okay, the department, or maybe yours or assistant commissioner of court team. So I keep saying a final thing in sites. Who would have the authority to authorize those site visits? Is it the assistant commissioner, or does it need that level of thing? But who gives the authority to make a site visit?
Usually during the in normal times when there's not in the midst of a pandemic, it is part of what is included in the job description, and that is, part of the director of nutrition services work. But because of the pandemic, it was in addition to, it's really looking at purposefully making a decision and working with our staff to determine if they felt safe, and they were able to make those site visits. But again, we did use alternate ways to be able to do site visits. It didn't require just solely going out. You could utilize, there were times where we utilized cell phones, and they had a 15-minute conversation. Be able to show what they happening in that location.
That's fine. Thank you, Commissioner. I know there's a lot of different things that go into it. So there were claimed to be serving 5,000. There were red flags going up. People were concerned. In the end, there was just an administrative review, and one would think that a site visit could have helped out a bit. Anyway, we'll move on. Thank you. So, do you believe in some of these cases that the DIRT commissioner, would you say that at this point, you're getting into 2021, there was a problem early, there was a problem in September when things got backed up with applications. FOF then filed suit, and they had a lot of things, they made a lot of claims. So we're moving forward, but do you believe that what went on in the department to mitigate this risk was insufficient? So was it insufficient to capture and stop the fraud?
It was not insufficient because we did capture and work towards stopping the fraud within the very first month of being able to look at Feeding Our Future's financial statements and what they were asking for meal reimbursements.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to so different area. Now I said we were staying within the department, but I'm just going to test the water on this one, Commissioner. Okay. There is a reason for it. So it's true that you did meet with Commissioner Fry in May of 2021, correct? Minneapolis Mayor Fry in May of 21, correct?
I can honestly tell you that I don't remember what month it was in. I don't have that in front of me. I did attend a meeting for introductions and then had to step away to another urgent meeting. Okay.
Thank you. Do you know, Commissioner, how many meetings there were with Mayor Fry
I believe that based on my understanding with my team is that there was only that one meeting.
Okay, thank you. Do you know, was Feeding Our Future a topic of that conversation when Assistant Commissioner Corte briefed you and give you updates? Did he tell you what the topic of that conversation was? Was it Feeding Our Future?
When our team followed back up to have conversations about what was it the topic of conversation, it was nutrition services, but there did not mention any specific sponsor.
Okay. I'm going to jump back here now for a minute. The scale of this ramped up pretty quick, and we got a lot of work, right? A lot of stuff going on, a lot of money coming in, a lot of people, organizations popping up. So due to the scale of this, can you tell me who informed the department, the OIG, the USDA Office of Inspector General, of the concerns about what was going on?
So thank you for giving us the time. We know that because the MDE does not have rulemaking authority and investigative authority, we do need to be able to reach out to the Inspector General or the USDA. There is a process in place that walks very specifically on how we're able to do that. I do know that being able to clarify exactly how that happened is we are limited in being able to say, but I can say that we do have processes in place that clearly get us to that point.
Sure. So you can't tell me who it was that notified. Was it you that notified OIG of the potential problems? And you're looking to the OIG for problems and or advice?
I can tell you that it was not me.
Okay. Do you know when that first contact was with the OIG? USDA, OIG?
I can look just for a second. I'm going to look in my, I do have the.
Sure.
In October of 2020, MDE escalated it to the OIG.
October 2020. Okay, thank you. So the next question gets escalated. So can you tell me, Commissioner, can you tell me who notified the FBI? Was that you that notified the FBI? Who notified the FBI?
Chair Chamberlain,
yes.
Again, at the request of our federal law enforcement partners, we'd ask that we not discuss the specific conversations between the MDE and its employees
Okay. And
the investigative
right.
authorities.
Thank you.
In this case. Thank you.
And I think we were already told that the FBI was informed in, was it April of 21 or was it May?
In April of 21.
Okay. All right. And it would be to your counsel, I imagine it would be foolish of me to ask for any documents and that would relate to that conversation and those communications. So I'll make it clear. Would we be able to get those documents and communications about that notification to the FBI?
At this time, Chair Chamberlain, we would not provide those.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. All right. I'm going to jump to couple other kind of critical things. We're going to be finished up here soon, so we're just going to continue here and wrap up. I don't have a lot left. In April of 2021, it was a be specific, is that the Pioneer Press had a story in which I believe Assistant Commissioner Corte was quoted, the desire to return to normal. desire to return to normal and to help, in quote, ensure the integrity of the program, unquote. He continued, said, there's a lot of nonprofits reporting large numbers of meals served, which has created a risk of fraud, a fraud risk, unquote. So did MDE, and after almost over a year of this, was there discussion, did they believe that fraud was being committed?
Chair Chamberlain, I know that Assistant Commissioner Cordy is going to be able to be with us on April 20th, and so I think that that would be
okay.
A conversation that would be better suited for him.
Thank you. Kind of a bookend to this. So a few months later, Assistant Commissioner Cordy, who got tied up in this unfortunate event of lawsuit, he was being deposed, a deposition, and you know, they were going through trying to narrow things down, obviously. There was a question in there. I'm gonna get it here. That was asked of Assistant Commissioner Corte. The question was, if MDE suspected intentional acts of fraud within these programs, question was from the other counsel, plaintiff counsel, asked if MDE suspected intentional acts of fraud within these programs. Assistant Commissioner Corte responded, no. I'm going to ask you, Commissioner, do you believe at that time, did you believe fraud was being committed in these programs? There were a lot of red flags. Your staff was doing the work. They saw stuff going on. So it is a pertinent question. Was there a suspicion within the MDE Department of Education that fraud was taking place?
Chair Chamberlain, I think that we know that because MDE doesn't have investigative authority, we aren't able to really identify if it's fraud or can it be able to identify what that is. We did have concerns based on the growth, the exponential growth that we saw, and the reports that were coming for forward for meal reimbursement. And so there was not a label or a title that I would be able to give at this point in time. We do know is that we raised flags of concern.
Thank you, Commissioner. So I'm going to jump back. Is connected to Mayor Frey. So there were conversations, or at least one meeting, between the Department of Education and Mayor Frey. And that may have been to discuss feeding our future issue, food nutrition programs issues. You said you were not there long, introed, and you, I think it said you were zoomed in, correct? During the period this was going on, I'm gonna ask, did you or then commissioner, when you were deputy commissioner or as commissioner, or commissioner then Mary Catherine Ricker, have any conversations and advise the governor that there may be problems?
Chair Chamberlain, as you know, that it was very clear because of all of the litigation that was happening that there was public knowledge of the concerns around feeding our future, and that there were also identifications of their lawsuit and subsequent lawsuit of that. And so we continued to keep the governor's team updated on what was happening through that litigation as we partnered, of course, with our colleagues at the Attorney General's office as well.
So is the answer to that question, the governor's staff was advised that there were problems in the program?
I can speak to, I did not have a specific conversation with the governor about that.
Do you know who on your staff, did Assistant Commissioner Corte have a conversation with the governor's staff to advise them of the problem, of potential problems.
I know that Assistant Commissioner Corday and a number of members of our team talked about like what was happening within the programs in and of themselves, knew that because of the litigation, we also wanted to keep them apprised of that.
Okay, so some people in your team, in the department, may have met with the governor's team to apprise them of some of the what was going on and challenges. So we started off by asking if somebody brought a team together when this whole thing started, because things were changing rapidly and there was a lot of money going to come in or started to come in. Some team got together to start talking about this. I'm not clear that in my mind that what happened was, okay, people, we're having a meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. We got this thing going on. We're going to come in this room. We're going to talk about this, how we're going to protect our system and how we're going to manage this. So I'm not clear that that happened. I don't think you were clear on the answer. I'll give you a chance in a minute if you want to clarify that. So let's bookend that on the backside. So now it's been going on. The FBI has been notified. OIG has been notified, talked to. The FBI has been. Lawsuits going. Things happening. So after the FBI executed search warrants, did you bring the team together to discuss, do like an after action report? Was there a meeting called to have an after action report to discuss what went wrong? What can we do better? Was there a meeting at some time, whether it's just before the warrants, at some time between the time the FBI was notified and they executed the warrants, right at that point, was there a point where you said, okay, team, we're going to get together and we're going to find out what happened, what went wrong, what can we do better? Was there that sort of discussion, a meeting?
So Chair Chamberlain, we did have the opportunity to, in a number of times, come back and talk about actually first and foremost what went right, because we were able to identify again within the first month that there were areas of concern. And even though we continued to encounter barriers, we still were able to get to the point where the FBI was investigating. And so we were thankful for the work of our team, their endurance throughout all of these pieces and their willingness to continue to, quite frankly, be dragged through the mud publicly with statements that we knew were not true. And so we first and foremost talked about that and thanked them for their work. The second thing is that we also know that in the pandemic, we had the opportunity to learn a lot of things. And as a learning organization, we identified places where, because of some of the waivers that we able to that were given, we knew that our system and structure gave us the opportunity to have updates. And so you'll note that there were three policies that we did put forward in the governor's bill to be able to help to reinforce a couple of things. One is to provide limits on how legally distinct CAC.
Hang on, Commissioner. Okay. I should have been a little more clear. But so you did have a meeting to discuss kind of an AAR, correct?
Yes.
And okay. I mean, I would imagine sometime in the new future, maybe before we end this session, that we'll have something in front of us we can look at to discuss with you, either in this forum or, you know, in a meeting. So I know that I was not approached or any to discuss solutions or things you needed legislatively to fix this. If it was staffing, the federal government provided some money that you could use for a variety of things. And I understand you did hire some staff with that money. about $10 million, I believe, if that's correct. If that's not correct, let me know. But you hired about 24 additional FTEs, is that correct? From the pandemic money, there was amount of money for this. So you hired about 24 FTEs?
Yes, that is correct.
And was $10 million about right, do you recall, give or take? That's a hard one to pull, but
yep.
I get all right.
We can certainly check. We think that's right, but I would like to go back and check that.
Okay, so you got the staff. There was staff. And I would say that that you were trying to get through tough. We were all trying to get through difficult times. But I'll say that this committee, at least I was here in 2021, we were not approached to do anything to address this issue that came upon you. There was some increase in funding where we could get into this, that, and the other with that, but there was increased funding and there was money from the feds to hire staff. So I guess for me, it begs the question that part of the planning process here, we'll just go to this and I think we'll wrap up, was there a discussion in those pre-meetings to reallocate any staff? I mean, at that time, I'll say you hadn't received the extra money yet. I get it. So at the beginning of this in April of 2020, you didn't have the $10 million and you had not yet hired the extra staff. But at some point, did you decide to reallocate staff within the department to address this particular issue? And again, I understand there were closed schools and you had to manage that, but there was also a ton of money coming through that ended up getting lost. So was there any discussion about reallocating staff in that process?
Chair Chamberlain, as the team had the opportunity to talk about what we needed, one is that there were some reallocation of staff to be able to help to provide support, and staff was not really the primary concern. Again, our team was able to catch and identify areas of concern within a month with the number of staff that we had available to us. And so, again, that is one piece we'll continue to look at, but there are policy pieces and there are, again, some our areas as a learning organization where we've identified for improvement. We did, I would like to say that we did offer to be able to talk through, I think, our policy pieces this year so that we can reiterate those three pieces of language that we had to move forward.
Thank you, Commissioner. Boy, I keep going back to sites. Sorry for bouncing around a bit. And then I probably got one or two more, and then we'll wrap up. So we talked about the site visit, what was being done was insufficient. If the site visits and the reviews, you suspected this stuff going on, there were problems, deficiencies, organizations popping up overnight. If they were successful, then the FBI wouldn't be involved, correct? If those processes and steps and site visits were successful, then the FBI would not have been involved, correct?
Well, Judge Chamberlain, first I'd like to go back.
Well, that's an easy one though, right?
Well, what I'd like to say is that we didn't say that they were insufficient. I think you did, but we did not say that they were insufficient. And what we said is that it is one component of a larger approach. And again, we were able to identify it within the first month. And we would say that we know that we were able to, as a team, our team was able to identify that within the first month. And so again, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney General's office has identified and praised the work of our team in being able to do this. I cannot say that even with that additional component, and we did do a site visit, again, for the pre-approval, for the preliminary approval of Feeding Our Futures to be able to even become a nutrition program.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, it's a difficult thing, right? Because you took over April 1 of 21. And there's a gap there, but but you were deputy commissioner for a while, but you said you weren't involved in that much. And Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker was more involved in managing it at that time. All right, okay. I got two questions left. One, I'm gonna ask, I got two, then Senator Swedinski has one, and we're gonna wrap up for the day. I appreciate your time and patience. Senator Isaacson, who had to leave, wanted to ask, the federal waivers, when were they issued? So we had the program come out and the feds issued a waiver. When were those?
The first waivers were introduced in March of 2020.
End of March. And that was that list of waivers.
Right.
For, okay. I have one more, Senator Swedinski, then I'll turn over. Thank you. So this is, so obviously Minnesota's the fraud here. And I'm not gonna say alleged, not you, but what happened was much larger than anything in any other state. In other states, Chicago, they didn't have this problem, at least not I heard of yet. I shouldn't say declaratively and confirmatively, but largest in the country. So what was it? I mean, we're not more inclined to this than other states. Is it in your opinion that are the administrative procedures that were in place at the Department of Education were much weaker than those other states? I mean, that's what we're trying to get at here. Find out where we can fix it.
So Chair Chamberlain, I would not say that. I would say that we're sitting here because our process worked. I think that we were able to identify the fraud or the alleged fraud that has been moved forward for Feeding Our Futures. What we do know is that at no time was responsibility of the Department of Education did the USDA waive our need to be able to continue to provide monitoring, and that is exactly what we did. That's why we were able to identify it in the very first month to be able to raise flags. That's why we walked through a process where we were being sued when we knew that we had areas of concern, and we're still needing to held in contempt in court the same month that we were began working with the FBI. And so I would say that our process worked. I can't speak about what's happening to other states, and I don't know if other states are looking into their funding to identify areas of concern, but what we know is that we were able to do this work and we were able to do it well.
Thank you, Commissioner. All right, Senator Swedinski, you had a question?
A question and a comment, or a comment and a question. Anyways, I've sat here for quite a while, and I got to admit, I'm in awe. I really, truly am. When I've been hearing the testimony and the timeline, and that you guys caught this in the greatest educational upheaval in 160 years of Minnesota history, when we were dealing with distant learning and hybrid learning and remote learning and parents and kids and bus drivers and cooks and social workers and counselors, and the whole system was being tested. And I imagine at the Department of Education, your phones and emails and computers were exploding every single day with a lot of questions by a lot of people. And that throughout all that, the system worked, that the public servants caught that there was something awry. And I hope on the 6th and the 20th, and I guess my question to you, and maybe this is a bit premature because maybe my question should be asked after we hear from some of the other testifiers that the chair is asked to come and present, but someone somehow suspected something was going wrong, and that that person, whoever we find out that it was, should be applauded at some point, because I'm sure this was not on their radar whatsoever, given all the tumultuous things that were going on. And so I hope that person gets a little plaque or gets celebrated at some point. And I'm really going to look forward to hearing the testimony, because my ultimately my question is, and maybe again this might be premature, but how did you get this right? And what lessons can we learn? Can the executive branch teach the legislative branch that this probably isn't going to be, maybe in our lifetimes, hopefully it will be, but the last pandemic that we're going to have to go through that's going to throw us into this, this what we just went through. And so how were you able to catch it, and what did you do right? And I hope that we take, and the OLA will take all those things that they're going to find out, and so we can continue to catch things when they go bad. So I thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, thank you, Senator Swedenski. Commissioner, that's kind of what I hope we'll get. That's not a question I want to get into now. That's the whole, that's a report at the end that should have answers to those questions. And that's what I alluded to earlier, that we need to have some sort of report that either from the OLA, the state auditor, or preferably the department itself, that says this is what happened, this is what we're doing to fix it. I'm just going to wrap up now so we can get out of here. People probably had enough of this. So that's kind of what we're getting at anyway, Senator Swedenski. It's just too broad to deal with at this point. I again thank the department for coming in. I thank you for your time and patience, Commissioner Mr. Uni. And as Hobel or Hubel?
Tobel.
Okay, thank you. I'm terribly sorry. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for the patience. Thank you, members, for indulging. Again, very large fraud. And the fact that other states it didn't happen in. So we're trying to get to the point where we can find out why that is. I mean, this sort of Minnesota was not the only state to receive this kind of money. Other states received more, maybe, and others less, but we're not the only state that received it. But thus far, I mean, PPP notwithstanding, thus far, we are the state where the 200 FBI agents descended upon these locations and have begun an investigation of a big investigation of this process, where almost $300 million was taken and communities were hurt and nonprofits concerned about their continued existence. So we want to make sure all nonprofits are not painted with a broad brush here. But there is a concern. There is a big concern that somehow $300 million kept going out the door over the year and a half, give or take a little over a year. And some people said it was found and caught. But if it was found and caught, it would have been stopped. The money kept flowing. And I don't think it's an affirmative defense to simply say, well, the court said something. There's nothing in statute that prohibits us from stopping theft when we see it. So I'm not casting aspersions on any particular individual at the department, but something went seriously wrong. Other states dealt with this. Other states stiffened up their accountability procedures to prevent this from happening. And they did this before pandemic. And then certainly it worked. So anyway, with that, I will leave it at that. We'll see you all on Wednesday. Members here, we'll see you tonight for the rollout of the bill. But again, thank you for your time, your patience, and helping us dig through this a bit. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.